Hello, morning, everyone. So just want to get a read. How many of you are currently students at Cornell? Wow, pretty significant number. How many of you are alums of recent vintage? And I'll let that be up to your interpretation. All right, so Mike and I had some similar experiences, it turns out. So Venture for America exists to solve this problem. It's a problem you probably thought very little about, but I'm going to try and expose you all to it, which is that if you're a bright recent graduate of a place like Cornell, the odds of you becoming a finance professional, management consultant, or heading to law school are quite high, and the odds of you heading to a startup are quite low, even for those of you who are interested in entrepreneurship, which I imagine is everyone here in this room. So pick on our friends at Harvard, just to bust out the numbers as to what the six default paths are for recent college graduates. Finance, law, consulting, med school, grad school, and Teach for America are the top six. They comprise between 50% and 65% of national university graduates. Then you can see what the other breakdown is. There's this undecided and traveling category, which to me is like, you know, they would go and find themselves and they come back and go to law school or something along those lines. So first, some feedback on these numbers. How many people see these numbers and say, like, totally shocking, totally unsurprising? All right. So it is unsurprising, and just to show it's not a Harvard thing, we have Cornell's top employers in 2011 listed, Penn, Duke, Columbia. It's all quite similar. My alma mater is not listed there, which is Brown. I graduated from Brown in 96 with an economics degree. I didn't know what to do, so I went to law school, which is what you did if you didn't know. Anyone else go to law school here? I'm sure. You guys are, some of you are well-dressed, and that means law school to me. So law school for me clarified very little. And I graduated and I was like, oh, what do I do now? I guess I become a corporate lawyer, because that's what everyone's doing out of Columbia. I went to law school at Columbia. So I joined a law firm called Davis Polk & Wardwell, doing M&A and banking work. Does anyone know what a corporate lawyer does? All right, sir.
Oh, boy, I raised my hand.
Yes. Yeah, so what does a corporate lawyer do?
We charge a lot, and we try to get paid.
Oh, wow, this is a we. You're a corporate lawyer, no?
I am.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, first of all, that's the most important thing. But also, seriously, we help with transactions.
Yes.
We help, first of all, set up companies, make sure that they're set up properly in the state they're supposed to be set up for. Generally, we help them raise money. We help them purchase other companies or be sold to them.
Yeah.
We help them get your contracts.
So when large companies want to do things, they hire a corporate law firm, like my old firm. What was your name, sir?
Rob Newman.
Rob. So Rob has a mental picture of what I was doing at the age of 24, 25, which is much less cool than what Rob's doing now as I'm sure a senior partner at his firm. For me, as a first-year associate, I was very much grease on the wheel, where there's like a large transaction happening, and you know, there are documentation that need to be reviewed, and I was one of Rob's army of document reviewers. So I went home to my parents' house in Westchester County, which I'm sure resembles like half of you. and I said to my parents, like, you know, I'm not sure this is the job you raised me to do. When I was a kid, I dreamt about going in the woods and killing something, not like being the guy who like writes down about the killing. And then my parents were like, we have no idea what you're talking about, son. And so I then did something similar to what Micah did, which is I went and left my job to start a company. I'll return to that in a minute. So if you have a high proportion of young people heading to professional services, where does that mean they're going to live? New York City, where else?
Boston.
DC. San Francisco, Chicago. Those are the top five. LA's number six. And then if you look around the country, you see that there are a lot of places that are struggling with economic dynamism, new business formation, job growth, and they're essentially non-overlapping with the exception of California, which can have massive problems in addition to San Francisco. So one of the things that, There's some California natives here that are like, boo, hiss. So one of the things we believe this map indicates is that if you're a really smart young person from, let's say, Georgia, and you go to Penn or Duke or Cornell, the odds of you going back to Georgia and starting a business are near zero, and the odds of you becoming a banker, lawyer, consultant in New York, D.C. very high. And if you do that for the last 25 years, and you end up with this picture, what do you think? Has anyone ever given any of these things any thought before, being like, wow, we have a lot of people doing certain things and not others? It's okay if you haven't, but any show of hands, someone? A couple of people have thought about this. So what is it, so those of you who are students, raise your hands again, I'm sorry. All right, I'm gonna pick on you for a minute. So when you were freshmen, you probably did not know what management consulting was, probably. And then let's say 10 to 15% of your classmates are going to pursue it or do it. So why is it then that that transition takes place? What are you all looking for that makes professional service paths so compelling? What are the factors? Actually, let's open it up to anyone. Like, why is it that so many people do the same things? Why did I go to law school?
Stability.
It's safe.
You lack a better idea.
Lack a better idea.
It's competitive.
Money.
Validation.
Parents. Social pressure. Prestige. Recruited. Progress. Opens doors. Keeps options open. Not sure what you're going to do next. Money, gain skills, community, do something good, make the world better, which includes banking, consulting, law, because you think you have to become a baller first, and then you can do good later. You can go back to the people with loaves of bread after you have ascended. So those of you who are students, what do you think of this list? Is this accurate?
Yeah.
So this is what motivated me out of Brown. I went to law school, became a corporate lawyer, and then I went back to my parents and said, hey, this isn't so great. So then I decided to try and go build something. So I left to start a .com in 99, 2000. It's called stargiving.com, I won't go into the idea, but so how many of you have started a company? A lot of you, I had that sense. So those of you who started a company, you remember your first fundraising experience? How many of you raised money for that company? So what was that like? Anyone want to shout out? I didn't talk about my experience, but scary. Was it easy, hard?
Hard?
It's super hard, right? How many of you have raised money for a nonprofit? If you don't have your hand up, you're probably a bad person. But raising money for a nonprofit's not easy, and that's asking people for like 20, 50 bucks or whatever just to get off your back or their back. So for a company, it's orders of magnitude harder. So as a 25-year-old trying to raise money, if a guy like me comes up and says, I started a company, it's like a magic trick. But what it means in practice is like I had a PowerPoint deck, I went to my friends, I said, hey, do you know any rich people that might want to give me and my company money? They say, I do know someone, and then you show up, and then you have the conversation with them about the company you're going to start, and it's got a $2.5 million valuation. So what do the people say when you ask them for money? That's a great, great comment. They do not say no. What do they say?
Later.
They also don't say yes. I've never had anyone just bust out a checkbook and be like, yeah. So what they always say is, this is very interesting. Let me think about it and get back to you. So they're not going to say no because you're in their living room and it's kind of awkward, because then you'd be like, oh, no, OK. And you generally know someone who knows them, so there's like a little bit of a social tie. And they want to keep tabs on you in case it turns out you're a genius. They can just double back later and be like, hey, I was always with you. And you're like, yes, so you were. So what you hear over and over again is, this is very interesting, let me get back to you. So that's what I heard as a 25-year-old. Went through my savings, moved out of my apartment. Really, really difficult. Starting a company was super hard for me. I think it's easier now. So eventually we raised $250,000. Built a site, went public in like a IPO sense, but like, you know, launched a website. We're in the press. I was on CNN with Hootie being like, we're going to change the world, because it was a celebrity thing. Then the bubble burst and my company dies like a lot of other people's companies. Yeah, how many of you are all, a lot of you were adults when the bubble burst. You guys are like, what were you all doing in like 2001-ish, 2002? So for those of you who are students, do you remember a time when your parents were really sad watching TV, like around like 2002, where you'd be like, why is the TV making dad so upset? So the NASDAQ went from like 5,000 to 1,800, like Micah's company, you got my little company dies. So at this point, I'm 25, 26, I still owe $100,000 in law school debt. I've just lost people $250,000 in investment. And my parents are like, what the heck happened to you? Like, didn't you used to be pretty bright? And so what advice would you give to 25, 26-year-old Andrew who just started a company that tanked? And let's say that Andrew wanted to become an entrepreneur, because that is the truth. So what do you tell him to do?
Try again,
very difficult in 2002, very difficult. Also, I do have this $100,000 in debt and other stuff.
Get a job,
what kind of job?
At a startup.
Well, yeah, so if you want to become a chef, what are your options? One, you go to chef school. But in my case, I already had lots of education, so it'd be kind of silly. And there really is no startup school in that sense, I'm not sure. I mean, some people could disagree with me on this. So the other thing you do is if you have like a chef, you can find a master chef and then kneel and say, please accept my knife. And then they say, arise, my son, and they like tap you. So that's what I did. I worked for a startup for 4 years, was the VP of something or other at a tech company that raised $7 million. I went to several million in revenue, and then I became the CEO of a company called Manhattan GMAT. Have you heard of Manhattan GMAT? I hope a few of you. So Manhattan GMAT became number one in the US in GMAT prep. I was the CEO, and then we grew and were acquired by the Washington Post Kaplan Division. So when I was there, I saw all of this stuff because I taught the analyst classes at McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, how to do on the GMAT. And so I saw very forcefully, it's like, hey, this is what's driving our young people. So those of you who are thinking about startups, which is many of you in this room, why is it that you're probably not going to join a startup after you graduate, at least the first thing? Money, what else?
Security.
Parents.
Parents, again. So those of you who are parents, remember this convo.
Access,
right. You're not recruited, because that's a lot of the story. Banks and consulting firms spend tens of millions in recruitment. What is the brand of Harvard Law School worth? Easily, probably hundreds of millions or billions. So startups cannot compete with this stuff. There's no path. You don't know what you're getting into. There's no built-in community. You don't know if you're going to advance or succeed. High risk, uncertain reward. So it's actually irrational to head to startups as opposed to these other things in many, many ways. So what if we were to magically rearrange things and say the same proportion of young people who are really, really enterprising and have high potential, instead of going to professional services, they're going to startups around the country, to Detroit, Baltimore, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Cincinnati, St. Louis, San Antonio, New Orleans, et cetera. Like, what if we just magically rearranged everything and sent our smart people to go build things and then did that year after year? How long would that take to meaningfully drive job growth and innovation? Over, under, anyone?
2 years.
2 years.
10 years.
The range is between 2 and 10 years, I would guess. We're going to find out. But no one has ever said this would not matter or this would not work. Because we all know that intellectual capital drives innovation, drives the economy, drives our society, actually. So in 2011, I left the Washington Post to start this organization, Venture for America, that recruits top college graduates from around the country, many Cornell grads. How many fellows are here in the room? I think we got a couple, right? Yes. Evan, David, anyone else? So top college graduates from around the country, we bring them to training camp. Then they will go work in startups in cities around the country, generally that are not on that list of cities that are already getting a lot of college graduates naturally. They spend 2 years building those companies, learning the way I learned by working alongside a more experienced entrepreneur. And then after the end of 2 years, they can either stay at those companies as managers and leaders, or they can start their own companies. We have a seed fund to invest in them that includes Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, as an investor, and other people. So the goal is to make it so that it's as obvious and appealing for a young, smart person to head to entrepreneurship and startups as it currently is to go to banking, law, consulting. What do you think? Yeah, let's do it. So our mission is to revitalize American cities and communities through entrepreneurship, to enable our best and brightest to create new opportunities for themselves and others, and restore the culture of achievement to include value creation, risk and reward, and the common good. And the great thing is everyone wants us to succeed, everyone wants this to happen, we just need to make it happen by building the bridge and connecting the various groups. So here are some of the fellows. Hey, Evan, are you on this? Are you on here? So I'm actually always curious, when people see these faces, what do you think? What are the common themes? Anything?
So, not enough women.
Not enough women, I agree with that. Attractive, I guess I'd agree with that. So So those of you who are students, if you have an interest, you can apply to Venture of America. Applications are open right now. Our acceptance rate's about 10%, so it's hyper-competitive. But we have people from all over the country in all different disciplines. So their majors, biochemistry, mechanical engineering, public policy, religion, social studies, art history. So it runs the gamut. You know, it's not just a bunch of, you know, the same sort of person, because you need lots of different people to make companies work. So a couple of quick stories. Here are four fellows are in Detroit. They bought that house for $8,200. They're rehabbing it, and then they started a software company for local landlords called Castle. So they're already doing good things. This guy, Brian Rudolph, was on this show, Restaurant Startup, and won $75,000 from Joe Bostian. Did anyone see this episode? Yeah, do you remember this guy? So it's high-protein, gluten-free chickpea pasta. It's being distributed in ShopRite, Eataly, Meijer, and it's off to the races. So young people will actually start companies if you incentivize them to do so and invest in them. It's like magic. You know, it's like if you give them $100,000 to go to law school, maybe they'll go to law school. If you give them $100,000 to start a business, maybe they'll start a business. I mean, let's do the latter, because we no offense to those of us who are lawyers in the room, but you know, but there's probably a little bit of a, it's not me, Bloomberg Business Week thinks there are going to be tens of thousands of underemployed law school graduates between now and 2020. So there's structural imbalances. So right now we have 212 fellows in 12 cities around the country. You can see them here. We're expanding to Nashville, Pittsburgh, Charlotte, and what's the fourth city? Indianapolis, I believe, this coming year. Our board and supporters consist of really fancy people, in large part because I knew that you know, there are many people fancier than me. And if you're going to get smart young people to walk this path, you need some serious resources. So I'm happy to say to date we've raised about $8 million. Our budget has gone from $200,000 in our first year, 2011. This year it's around $3 million. We're heading to about $5 million next year. So there are a lot of people who want to solve this problem. I'm going to stop here just take any questions, because I'm doing a lot of talking. So if you're a student, you have any questions? You want to apply to this thing? Yeah.
How do you volunteer in this program?
What do you mean?
You take only 10% of your applicants.
Yes, we do. You know, I don't think that's a limiting factor, though, because if you have enough people, you can take 10% of like a million people, it'd be a lot of people, right?
Then you have 212 fellows
currently. Yeah, so, you know, you have to start somewhere. I mean, you're going I mean, the way to scale it is you just raise lots and lots of money and build the thing huge, which is my job. So feel free to keep up with you know, keep up with the organization in the coming years. Like, that's what I meant. Yeah. We're looking for people that have the potential to contribute to the growth of a company and then potentially start one themselves someday. So the hook we're looking for is that you're really good at something. And it does not need to be any one thing. So if you've started a business, great. Good at school, great. Started organizations, great. Overcome a lot of personal adversity and like showed a lot of grit, also very positive. Captain of athletic team, you know, anything that a company can say, okay, I can see that person doing X at my company, helping it grow, and then hopefully having you grown to a leader. Yeah?
Why do this first instead of going to a Series A or B startup?
Well, there's the list of things that people are looking for in terms of skills development, professional network, optionality, prestige, parental cover, things like that. You know, we think we help provide, but there's no right answer. So it could be that someone would be better off doing something else or going directly to a startup. We don't have any, you know, like hard line about that. Yeah.
Have you considered open access for your training for those highly motivated?
Yeah, so we're working on options right now for the 90% that don't get in, because we feel bad about that. We don't like excluding people. That's certainly not the reason I started anything. I mean, that'd be kind of a jerk thing to do, be like, I'm going to start something and exclude people. So that's not the plan. All right, so this is me with President Obama in the White House. He seems to like it. So our plan is to help create 100,000 new US jobs by 2025. And for all the talk about job creation, it's really straightforward how you do it. The first thing you do is you help early stage companies grow, expand, hire more people. And second, you train a critical mass of your top prospects to become business builders and job creators. It's pretty straightforward. So 100,000 new US jobs by 2025. And the thing that I've learned over the last few years is that if you want to create companies, what you really want to do is you want to create the sort of people that are going to create companies. And that's something I've learned, that having fellows transition from well-intended recent college graduates to gritty builders, seeing that happen is magic. And the fact that we've already seen that happen in the last several years gives me a lot of hope. So thank you very much. I'll be around to answer any questions you have a little bit later on. Thank you for this opportunity. Go Cornell. Big Red, Flight of Venture for America.
You can get a few more questions.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
All right, Micah has authorized me to take another question or two. Sorry?
Yeah, like all good entrepreneurs, he's gone a little off script. So we have 10 minutes, I think, on the clock over there. So you can text in your questions.
Oh, really? There's a timer.
Or I'm going to ask Andrew very, very personal questions. So I suggest you text them in instead.
Or just shout them out.
Or you can just shout them out.
Oh, so what we do is we go to a city, let's call it Baltimore, and then we say, what are the innovation organizations in the city? So it's, in that case, TEDCO. So we say to TEDCO, what are the up-and-coming startups and growth companies in this city? They introduce us to them. About half of them end up being a fit, but then the CEOs of those companies know another set of companies, and then we have a team that just goes around and gets a sense of the talent needs at those companies and determines whether we think they'd be a fit. And if they are a fit, it's not like they automatically get a fellow. We had 200 opportunities for the 105 fellows this past year, and they were on a portal, and then the fellows look at them and then pitch themselves to various companies, so a lot of companies don't end up getting one. So there's a market mechanism as well. But the vetting happens in the cities through innovation organizations, and our team does some due diligence.
So Andrew, someone texted in, can international students apply? Typically startups shy away from the bureaucratic visa process.
So this pains me on a personal level, but we can't do something for the company that they can't do themselves in many respects. And so if they can't navigate the visa process for an international student, then you know we don't have the resources right now to enable that to happen. If any of you have friends in Washington, D.C., if you could help clean that up, that would be great. Be great for the economy, be great for society. But right now, this is a stumbling block. We've had one international student and company take this on, but it's still a real barrier, honestly.
I'll curate these a little bit for you. What tip do you have to current college entrepreneurs?
What tip do I have?
Like, yeah, what advice would you give to a current?
The biggest tip I'd have is to get outside of the classroom to the extent you can. So some of the people that we've found a lot of success with are people that have, for example, like worked at Cornell student agencies or like worked in a business. If you work in a business context, that's actually great entrepreneurial training. It's not necessarily I started the business, but just interacting with customers on a daily basis, with budgets, with money. So if you can, the more real it is, the better. It's really easy to imagine things, imagine a company. That stuff's not that useful. So if you can find a real business and drive some value and help, that's going to be a much more profound experience. It's going to broaden you.
Can only undergrads apply, or grad students, or even people who've been out 3 years, or maybe 15 years in my case, apply to the program? Just checking.
So we say recent college graduate. We have people who've done analyst programs, then come to Venture for America after, where people have gotten master's degrees and whatnot. So we say recent college graduates, typically from 0 to 3 years. And you can actually even apply as a junior this year and then have an offer waiting for you for afterwards, because we're trying to compete with banks and consulting firms that interview you very early. So anywhere from junior college to, let's say, 3 years out.
Why?
Why what?
Now,
it's partially because of the pay scale. We're like standardizing for companies so that if I'm a Baltimore startup, I kind of know what I'm getting into in terms of like the monetary commitment and the sort of talent I'm onboarding. Part of it's social, that like if you bring 150 people together for a residential experience, you kind of want there to be certain commonalities, common experiences.
Andrew, what growth have you seen from the organization so far? Or in VC speak, what metrics are you looking at to measure success?
So there are three inputs to what we do. The first is the talent input, which is the one I find most interesting. So this year, we're going to have between 1,500 and 2,000 applications for about 150 spots. Duke is our number one feeder. We have fellows from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Caltech, MIT, Cornell, Penn, like every top university is represented. And so it's not like we're getting people. The thing that I always was blown away by is how strong the people that are applying to us are. So it's not like we're taking 10% because the other 90% aren't good. Like the people that are applying are really good. We're like you know, struggling with that. So the talent's coming our way in a big way. Then there's the cities and companies. So we had 200 opportunities for this past year, and that's another metric we look at. We're going to grow from there. And then our own budget, you know, has gone from 200K to 5 million next year. The biggest metric I think about, honestly, is the experience of the fellows, because like I know them. Like you ask like Evan and David. I actually played basketball with David this week. Is that right? Yeah. So it's very human. Like the fact that 25% of our fellows have started companies out of that first year strikes me as like a very high level, because starting a company is super hard, and we don't recommend it for everyone. So the fact that 25% of the fellows started companies and about half of them are working in startups in a VFA city, we think is awesome. So that's the metric I care about.
How do you define a startup? What is the cutoff? And maybe just on that, does it have to be a venture scale startup? Are there different types of small businesses that you...
So we're not tech specific. We want to create US jobs, and actually non-tech companies tend to create more accessible job growth. We're not venture specific. So startup is very broad. I actually say early stage growth company. And in this span of companies, that could be up to like, you know, let's say like 10 years old, like, you know, as long as they're growing quickly. So our smallest company has 2 people. Our largest company has generally around 80 people. We have one company with 200 employees, but when we started working with them, they had 6. So they went from 6 to 200. Our fellow was the 6th employee. And now they have 200 employees. So that's the profile. But we're not industry specific. We're not even venture specific. There are a lot of businesses out there that aren't venture investable. Like my business was not venture investable. Like if Manhattan GMAT had gone and said, hey, try and get VC, like no one would have invested. But we grew to tens of millions of dollars and were acquired for tens of millions of dollars. So it's like a really good business. It's just no venture investor would have been interested. So there are a lot of businesses that are like that.
By the way, we would not have said no. We just wouldn't have said yes, just to clarify.
That's true.
How we would have reacted to Manhattan.
This is true. You would have been very interested.
We would have gotten back to you later.
Yeah.
I think it's a good question around how do you prepare. You know, you made this comment about you can't teach entrepreneurship, yet in a sense, you are trying to.
Oh, I didn't say that. I actually do believe you can teach entrepreneurship.
Well, something about schools can't teach entrepreneurship, I think, was maybe the comment. But anyway, how do you deal with the ambiguity of a startup?
You have to know what you're getting into. Like, we try and scare people. Like, people should not back into Venture for America or startups generally. I think if you do it when you're young, it's great because you get that exposure. I think young people should do 3 things. They should work for a big company, at least for a summer. They should work for a startup, at least for a summer. And then they should try and figure out which one they like better. You know? So, like, as long as you have that breadth, then you can make an informed decision. But startups are not for everyone. The more exposure you get, the more you can find out whether you're a good fit for them or vice versa.
There's a question about picking cities. How do you pick cities for VFA, and are you looking to expand?
So we're expanding this year, every year probably. We're looking for cities that have a robust ecosystem of up-and-coming companies. So there are cities that want us that just don't have the companies that we don't see as a fit. If we were to take some very smart people and put them in the middle of a cornfield, like no magic would happen. They would just, you know, starve in the cornfield. Well, maybe they'd eat some corn and, like, I don't know, become malnourished because corn is not very... Anyway, so like you have to put them in a system where there are things that are growing. And so that's the first thing we look for. As a nonprofit ourselves, we also look for local partners that want to fund our arrival in a city and help create a welcoming community for fellows. Because the hope is that the fellows become embedded in that city and then potentially even start companies there. So I feel funny answering disembodied questions. Anyone like raise your hand? Even if your question's up there. Just like, yeah.
How do you measure intangible skills, intangible time?
So how do you measure intangibles? Our selection process is very involved. So we have a set of experienced humans who spend a lot of time with you and try and figure it out. We all also invested a lot in this like psychometric like evaluation that may or may not be fruitful. We'll see. but it's a lot of time. You know, like so there are 3 ways to get things done in business, or in this case, nonprofit. It's people, processes, and technology. And if you're dealing with people, it's really hard to just process it out. So the way to try to figure out what's going on inside a person is with other people. Yeah? They don't typically get equity, but they sometimes get equity. It just depends upon the nature of the company that they're joining, nature of the management team, nature of the equity structure. But it should not be an expectation, but it has happened. So one last question.
You have one down.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, the woman. Yes. You know, unfortunately, as Micah can attest, even if you do everything right, you can still fail. So it's not like there's like the recipe for, you know, success. But the thing we focus on, there are broadly three things you need to start a company: financial capital, team and talent, and product market fit. And the companies that don't have the right team and talent are the ones that are most likely to fail. Because if you have the right team and talent, you can get the money and you can figure out your market and service. So that's one of the things that's driving Venture for America, is that we want you all to become part of quality teams that can build growth companies. So that's the single most important variable, is that if you have the right people, you can do anything. So thank you all very much. Have a great day today. And please do check us out at Venture for America. And apply if you're a student.
That was awesome.
Apply.
Great job. That was inspiring.